Well, we know what it's like to feel worried and helpless about the state of our world.
But we're finding comfort and inspiration from people tackling winner-take-all economics and other root causes of climate change, inequity, and global unrest.
Join us on the road from wasteland to wonderland. This is Pot of Gold.
Our Pot of Gold team is also working in lockdown mode, so we would like to apologize for any weird sounds and different sounds from online recording to different kind of equipment, but we hope you will enjoy the episode. This week, we are talking about the one thing on everyone's mind. What else could it be but the coronavirus?
We were lucky enough to interview two extraordinary guests for this episode. The first you'll hear from is Clarissa DaCosta, one of the founders of the Center for Global Health at the Technical University of Munich in Germany. She's been working as a clinical expert for the university's team tackling the coronavirus.
Our following guest is a young woman named Qingjing Yang, a student from Wuhan, China, who has spent the last several years studying engineering abroad in Europe. She shares with us her experience of the response to the coronavirus, both in Wuhan, where the virus first broke out, and now Germany, where she's living.
We wanted to know not only what we're doing to address the global crisis we're in now, but what we can learn about this pandemic that will help us come together around other issues the world is facing. How can we come out better equipped and more resilient on the other side?
Let's dive right into it with Clarissa.
If you wouldn't mind just introducing yourself and what your role is and the work you're doing right now with coronavirus.
So my name is Clarissa DaCosta. I'm a medical microbiologist. Actually, I'm trained in infectious diseases. So I'm a consultant also in infectious diseases. But when it got really obvious that the coronavirus will have a major impact also on our hospital, my boss asked me whether I would join forces with our hygiene expert, even though I'm not an expert. I clearly have to say this. But nevertheless, join forces and try to help wherever I can. And I agreed very quickly because, I mean, of course, knowing that the situation is already severe and would become even more severe. I agreed on that. And so ever since then, so that's more than 4 weeks ago, I'm in the Department of Hygiene and part of our clinical expert team on coronavirus, which is a team, an interdisciplinary team of not only doctors, very clearly, not only doctors, which are on a daily basis actually treating patients, but also the virologist, of course.
Clarissa, you said it was surprising. Coronavirus was surprising. What exactly do you mean? Like the pandemic, really, or the lockdown, or what was so surprising to you?
Well, I think what was surprising for we, like for many others, was that in January still, even though we saw what was happening in China, the sense of it being a, you know, larger threat or a pandemic took a while to happen. This is why I would probably say it was sort of surprising.
Do you imagine that if it happened again, the response would be different?
For sure. Just think about the Corona app, which is being implemented, where we already are experiencing some experiments with our local, the German healthcare Robert Koch Institute. Yeah, that's the public health institute of Germany, the national one, which will allow us to localize small outbreaks and to inform people upon their wish whether they have had contact with a potential coronavirus carrier. Mm. And I think these kind of apps and the experience, especially for the Germans, with the potential there is with these kind of apps, will be something that will be sustainable also for the future, I think.
I have a kind of a equally important question. We, you know, beyond the world of virus, we also face other global challenges like climate change. Do you see any parallels between our ability to respond to this virus and what we've learned and those larger issues that we also face?
Of course. And I think, and I've been thinking about this actually a lot. And so one thing that coronavirus teaches us upfront is how quickly unthinkable things can be thinkable or are even implemented right away. It's just like this, right? So,
yes.
And I think this should be also transported as a positive message. You can do it, right? There's a lot you can do globally if you want. And this is one thing. This is more of a, well, holistic point of view on the coronavirus epidemic, I guess. But again, now turning to politics, because obviously this will be the major issue of politicians. I read a interesting article this weekend in the Zeit, an interview actually with Ursula von der Leyen. She's the president of the European Union currently, and maybe you know, but she has proclamated at the very beginning of her presidency the so-called Green Deal. What she said was, despite having a Green Deal, she will have a green and white deal. She's calling this now the green and the white deal, which I think is extremely intelligent. And to be very honest, I was very happy reading that interview because nothing will change without having strong and, sort of intelligent leadership. And the European Union has to really come out of this pandemic, hopefully even more unified and even more strong. And Green Deal and White Deal.
So the White Deal meaning viral response, basically.
White economic. In terms of health, if you want to. Just realizing that climate change also has an impact on health, and also reflecting about a time after coronavirus. So just to give you an example of how this, a very small example in the end of what I mean. So as I said in the beginning, an important issue in coronavirus is obviously resources that we need for personal protection gears. And everywhere, everybody needs it, especially healthcare workers need a personal protection. So, And in the light of those personal protection, so surgical masks, gowns, and so on, goggles, you name it, everything became very scarce. And at one point, even in Germany, we were suddenly thinking about, hey, wait a moment. I mean, it says you can only use it once, that the companies say that, but is that really true? So is there not a way where we can re-sterilize these things and use them again and again? And what does it need actually to do that? And to make a long story short, there was so much pressure obviously there, and so much understanding also from the political side, that, for example, the Austrian government in the end issued interim law allowing re-sterilization of masks, so personal protective masks, which I think is fantastic because it works. It does work. And that, again, due to the pressure on health, we needed to do something which you might term as something that an idea towards circular economy. So reusing things, this is just an example.
That's great. I wondered if you could speak a little bit to I know that as a virologist, you're not really engaging the economic side of these things, but there is obviously quite a lot about our communities and their economic life that is affected by the virus. Have you thoughts about how to keep these our communities more resilient when it's hit with a pandemic, or you know, what kinds of responses would make us have less pain associated with both the before effects and after effects?
I mean, one of the things that has been discussed, of course, is to have more of an intelligent local economy. You know, that is one thing. And again, I turn to that example that I just gave you. So the personal protection. So more than 90% of the surgical masks that were used here were produced in Wuhan area, so in China.
Wow.
So yeah. So and our government has actually reinforced companies. I mean, the know-how is there here to start suing and producing these masks themselves. So that makes you obviously a lot more resilient and able to respond quick without having to fear too much, and having also not being dependent too much on the resources and global resources and shipments and so on. Yeah, I think this is the first time a global health emergency has hit us here, right? So and that will change, for sure. It will change the world. It will change a lot of how we are now perceiving also low middle income countries, and there because we're realizing that now really it's really imminent and very, very clear. If we don't, for example, build resilient systems and help build resilient systems in low middle income countries, this virus will get back to us very easy, you know? I mean, yes. Even if we are able to, if we would build walls, whatever, it will not help, right? So it teaches us a lot about our interconnectedness, obviously, and it teaches really anyone who has never thought about it, about this, right?
Yeah. Clarissa, I actually have one last question to you, because we touched on the knowledge we actually have and how we are at the moment tackling this for the first time global crisis, which I think has a lot to do with also an awakening of a global consciousness, how to deal with all of this. And so my question to you would be, what are you afraid of? What could come or could not come?
Well, probably I'm just an optimist, and I think, you know, let me put it like this. Health is something that everybody wants, right? And everybody would probably, if you ask the people, range health even above money, right?
Well, so or health precious... is wealth is health, you know. Yes. It's almost the same word.
It's health is wealth, but it's not money. And it's not about if you could buy health, right, you would give a lot. And if you would buy health, so in terms of global health, suddenly you understand that it is about global responsibility. And I think there is a lot music behind it, I should say. And I think people now, more and more people can understand that. And I hope, my hope is that, you know, combining these global determinants of health, and climate change is definitely one of the global determinants of health. Combining these things in an intelligent way will give politicians also more power to drive, you know, new avenues, like I just mentioned, circular economy and stuff like this, to bring the things together in a much better way.
Wonderful. I really appreciate this. We are so excited to have you on the podcast. And stay healthy.
Yeah, I'll try to.
It's hard on the front lines. We appreciate what you're doing.
Okay. Okay.
Cheers. Take good care. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye, you both. Bye. Bis bald. Bis
bald.
Cheers. Ciao.
It was such an honor to have Clarissa join us here on the show of Pot of Gold. Just a huge thank you to everyone who is doing their part in this crisis, and especially to those in health. We feel very grateful to have someone like Clarissa, who's so thoughtful and good-hearted, to be making a difference. A big, big thank you.
Yeah, it was really great to hear the clinical side of fighting the coronavirus. I'm also interested in like what's happening on the ground, especially from country to country. And we have this unique guest today, Xinjing Jian, and she's grew up in Wuhan and is living in Germany. So she has a unique perspective about the different responses, and we're excited to have her introduce herself. First, Xinjing, would you please just introduce yourself and tell us a little bit where you're from and where you are now and why you're where you are?
Okay, cool. Sure. I'm Xinjing from China, from Wuhan, and I'm currently studying electrical engineering in Germany. Well, I've lived in Germany since 5 years, so which maybe allow me to know a bit more about the, let's say, the Western society, or a bit more about the culture stuff here, which might also help me to understand like the differences between two countries, or just two different social structures, I would say that.
So could you tell us a little bit, let's just jump right in, about what it was like when the virus broke out in Wuhan and you were in Germany? What happened?
At that time, I still have a little bit distance to Wuhan because, you know, I'm in Germany. I was in Germany. So I just heard the things, but you don't feel that much. But till the day where the lockdown came out. So that news was, I guess, out in the night, like 2 o'clock in the night in Wuhan. So well, here was just after my dinner, I read the news, and that was a shock for me, to be honest. Like 2 minutes, or maybe I was there, like I was in silence like for 10 minutes. And then I just write emails to all my supervisors or my teachers, say, oh, sorry, I can't attend the meetings afterwards, or I can't go to the work tomorrow like that, because I can't concentrate anymore. And it's not only that the city, so the border of the city is locked down, but also you are not allowed to get out of your building anymore. Wow. And yeah, so in that sense, you know, it's like you don't know, and even you have no idea how long it will keep like this. So, and that's why I was extremely worried about it, because I just can't imagine till now. I still can't imagine how did they make it? You know, my family, they stayed at home for almost 2 months. Well, by the way, the latest news is that they're now allowed to go out, or let's say walk normally on the street with mm-hmm. kind of QR code. Like they can scan it where it keeps all your health information.
It sounds like Wuhan has already a technological infrastructure. Could you speak to the similarities or differences in terms of maybe the socioeconomic structures between China and Germany that allowed for a different kind of response? Like, what is it that makes it easy to say shut down and people stay home for 2 months in China, whereas in Germany, it's hard to even stay home for a day because you can't get food delivered.
That's actually a very good question in the sense that we also have like tons of talks about it, because to be honest, my hometown Wuhan is a huge city of actually over 10 million residents. It's not that easy just to lock the people there, and you have to take care of them. So not only food, but also, you know, those medical resources, also doctors were sent there. So the newest statistic I read is that they already sent, I guess, 42,000 people to the city, just of the medical system. They sent so many doctors there. Because at the very beginning, people were so worried about, okay, they want to contain the spread of the virus, they lock down the city, so that people stay inside and then the virus get cut down in the sense. That was not the case. It's like, you know, they locked you, but then they bring all the resources to you. And of course, it's of course of because of our, let's say, not only economical system, but also probably, if we have to talk about it, the cultural and might also the political system, in the sense that we are quite centralized. And yeah, it is different in two countries, because what I've seen here in Germany is that each, they call it Bundesland, probably each state, they have their own power to make their laws in some sense. And at the very beginning, I heard that the Robert Koch Institute, so the institute, the National Health Institute, was so they suggest people to, especially the elder people, to stay at home like that. But some of the states here, the local government, they said, okay, just a recommendation, we don't have to work after that. But in China, it couldn't be the case. I mean, if it's decided, then all the provinces, they will follow it.
Yeah, it seems like it was a very successful containment. When you now look at Wuhan versus, for example, New York, which is the new epicenter of the virus, the growth rates in Wuhan were leveled off quite quickly. You know, they kind of capped out at 80,000 or something like that in all of China. And we're, I think, well over 100,000 here already in the United States. And that's only the beginning of the curve. So it seems pretty different in terms of the ability to, lock down effectively. That seems to be really an important part of the whole process.
Yeah, but I think maybe it could also link to the thing that I think something people outside might not understand or might not expect is that actually it is mandatory in Wuhan, but it's just suggested in other part of China. But why people really stay at home for such a long time? It's not just because the government said this. It's also, we do want to do that. It's like volunteering. Because, you know, sometimes I read the news where say those states that it's dictatorship or whatever. It's so, to my understanding, it's not the case. It's really like we want to stay at home, or we want to have a better future in that sense. Otherwise, imagine that we have so many people there. How can the government just say, okay, stay at home, and then we stay at home? But also maybe cultural, because if you compare the movies we have, so for me, my personal feeling is that in the Western world, like, we really appreciate that the single hero. It's like, you know, the Hollywood film, a hero saved the whole world. But actually, if we look back to the Chinese movies or most of our movies, like, people work together and then we save the world at the end. Maybe it could, you know, reflect a little bit of the cultural differences between us.
And what can you say about the economic impacts? Like, what will it be after the virus moves out and you say people are starting to come back into society? Do you think there'll be a fast ramp up back to the way things were? I understand that the skies are clear for the first time. And what do you think the next steps will be to recoup the economic impact?
I don't know. Maybe, you know, the consumption need were lower, because there was a period that I was abroad, and I heard people say, okay, there are Chinese tourists all over the world, and they are buying the world. So they're buying the whole world. Yeah, there is. And some, you know, some experts say, okay, probably after the crisis, there will be a huge jump of the consumption need. I don't know. But to be honest, I feel that in the sense that people are not worrying about their life. They say, okay, we now have to save money. We now have to somehow go through it.
But do you think when you say, like, okay, people, younger people may have less money to spend, so hence they will probably consume a bit less. Do you think there will be a change, like a conscious change of what they, where they put their, what's the currency called in China again? It's not the dollar, but so, you know, so where they put the money. The Chinese yuan. How they spent the money. Do you think there will be a bit of a mind shift, or has this impacted how the Chinese maybe think about the environment, how they consume?
So my private feeling is that on the environment, maybe not that much, because it's already a huge, so it's huge debate in China, because we really suffered on the smoke, right? And it's not a question of yesterday, it's like a question there for over years. So we, most of us are aware, especially the young generation, we are aware that there's this problem. But there was always, you know, compromises, because you want to have, you know, development, you want to have a better industry. And it's really hard to now to really say that whether it will have a huge impact on the environment, because I don't believe that people will give up their cars, for instance. I don't believe that it's a directly changing that way.
Looking into the future, you said you imagine more viruses coming. And do you believe that there is something that in Wuhan or even in Germany that would really significantly improve the way this has gone for us?
Definitely. Actually, I think that so one thing could ever change is the speed of response of the government. Because actually, I mean, you might heard about the SARS 17 years ago in Wuhan, or not in Wuhan, in China, in Guangdong. And basically after that, the whole sort of reaction system or the response system in China were actually established and also, you know, updated. And also this time, the setup of the hospital, I guess, within 7 days, were actually based on the experience we had that time in Peking to build up a new hospital. So the last point I might want to make is that, I mean, I have a feeling like, you know, lots of my Western friends, my European friends, they came to me and asked, okay, so is that the case that your Chinese government now want to make this kind of propaganda? So it's like the image that they share to the outside that, oh, look, we won the war like that. But I was saying, don't take things in that way. So I think, so to me, that's all about interpretation. So what I feel is that first we are human beings. We have to survive under such a crisis in a global scale. It's not that I'm from China, you're from, you know, US, from the States, or from somewhere else. But first of all, we have to share and try to win the war together. It's not about me, myself, because China can't isolate itself from the rest of the world, right? So if the rest of the world are now under crisis, we can't somehow really prevent ourselves in front of them. So I really don't like to talk to my friends about, you know, is that any advantage of such a centralized structure, or is an advantage of, you know, we call it the democracy system here. Yes, maybe it will bring us some benefits in such a crisis in China, but that's just all side stuff. The main stuff is that what can we learn from it, and what can we share with the others so that we all keep, you know, living, keep existing in the world. And that's what I really care about.
Wow, fantastic. Well, the one thing I've heard, right, is that the Chinese with opportunity and crisis, it's kind of the same word. And I wanted to ask you if this is actually true.
So the thing is, so crisis actually is a word in Chinese that is out of two different Chinese symbols. The first one is danger or crisis, and the second one is chance. And so it's like two symbols. Yes, it is true. And also, I think that has to be linked to our philosophy. Maybe you've seen this black, white, yin and yang, or maybe heard some of Chinese stories that we always say that a thing always has two sides. So it's a two-sided stuff, that you always have opportunities alongside with those risks that you have to take. And also in some bad stuff, you can also see the hope out of it. That's actually one of our most important philosophy, I would say, is the sense of harmony. We always say harmony. We don't like, you know, to be too extreme on any side. We always want to be in the middle, right in the middle. It's this kind of mixture.
Yeah. All right. Very fun to talk to you, Shinzhen.
I'm really glad to talk to you.
Wonderful.
Go Berlin.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye.
Thank
you so much. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Bye.
So for me, it's been really cool to see the different perspectives of how we're dealing with the coronavirus. But increasingly, I'm having conversations with friends and family that are really speculative about what's going to happen next. Like, how are we going to recover economically from this situation?
Okay, I didn't actually get most of what you said because it was all frozen. I'm sorry, I basically got the beginning and then the resilient economy.
I can't hear a word you're saying.
Just saying. I just, you know, the thing just went froze, and I only got what you said in the beginning, which was something you thought was very cool, and then that we should build a resilient economy, and I cannot agree more. We should build a resilient economy, and whatever you said, I hope I'm not repeating this now.
Well, I'm just saying,
this global crisis we are having at the moment, will have a massive impact, or already has a massive impact on people, you know, on the economy and on people, whether you are getting a salary or not. And people talk about it, you know, all the time. Hey, am I going to be paid? Am I going to be laid off? And what's going to happen? So the insecurity at the moment is drastic. And the more we talk about it, I think the more we're going to push this unstable economy into the brink of that it's going to fail. It's going to fail in us. So we don't actually have the resilience built up, which we could have. I hear a lot, you know, from people also that this is like a wake-up call. This is like a test to humanity, a test to our society. Indeed it is, you know, and it's interesting how we are dealing with it. Like Clarissa is dealing with her team coming to the conclusion that interdisciplinary is a good thing. You know, who would have thought that we're getting out of the silos and actually, you know, putting our brains together, picking our brains and coming up with maybe new different solutions to a problem. And so when I hear a wake-up call, which is so obvious, and I hope we are waking up to let's make money our servant instead of our master. I hope we're waking up to that kind of conclusion. Hey, that it has something to do with our money system. We can't go back. We cannot go back to an old world.
Yes, but it's us. Yeah, exactly. I think that's such a profound point. And this idea of a mind shift that you're talking about is really key, that hopefully what this global event teaches us is that we really are in this together. We are interconnected. We are not autonomous people who have to beat out everyone else in order to survive. But I actually really worry that we're going to snap back like a rubber band, because in a time of scarcity, which we're facing now, a time of real scarcity, fear usually takes over. And so you have to secure
that
you.
That is something everyone, sorry that I interrupt you there, Mel.
Well, that's okay if your point is better than mine.
No, please. I'm sorry.
All I'm saying is that when fear is the pervasive feeling, people tend to be out for themselves. And this is a time in fear when we really need to be not only for ourselves, but each other and for the planet as a whole. And if we can maintain that mentality, we can take big, this can be the wake-up call that you're talking about, a transformative wake-up call.
Okay, I think at that point, I would like to get a quote out from Carl Gustav Jung, which is a, do you know the guy? He's
Jung?
Jung, yeah.
Yes, I've heard of him.
Okay, there's a quote that is, that which we do not bring to consciousness appears in our lives as fate. That thing which is currently happening to us is not fate if we bring it into light.
Yeah, it's a blind spot. In other words, a blind spot that we, if we become aware of it, we can incorporate it and overcome it.
We can integrate it into the whole and actually come out even better as a whole, hopefully, you know, in our planet.
Yeah. Yeah. Please keep in mind that these recordings may not be as high quality as they usually are because we're doing them in a time of social distancing. But thank you to Zoom for allowing us to continue making this podcast.
We're an independent, listener-supported podcast.
Thanks to our producer, Riley Paul.
Support us by rating this episode and sharing with all your friends.
And to learn more, join us at podofgold.world.
I'm Stephanie Overbach.
And I'm Mel Wymore.
Thanks for listening.